From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Physicist Arno Penzias is in the business of discovery and innovation. One of his discoveries earned him the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1978. Now he heads the researchers at Bell Labs. On this edition of Fresh Air, Arno Penzias tells us how to embrace all the new technologies, and he explains how chocolate bars can lead to scientific breakthroughs. Are these like the Ghirardelli Prizes for Physics? Also today, actor and director W.H. Macy shaped his sense of theater from his long collaboration with playwright David Mamet. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the first feature film from New Zealand film director Jane Campion. Those are today's specials here on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. According to Soviet Central Television, troops trying to end ethnic warfare in the Azerbaijan Republic have been given clearance to shoot at combatants in self-defense and to protect arms and ammunition dumps. The announcement said the order was issued after a series of attacks on government weapons stores. As many as 76 people have been killed in the escalating conflict between Azerbaijanis and Armenians, which prompted the Kremlin to declare a state of emergency in the region. Before the end of the week, 9 members of the Salvadoran army are expected to be charged for the November murders of 6 Jesuit priests and 2 Salvadoran women. Tom Gibb reports from San Salvador.
A civilian judge has until Friday to bring charges or drop the case. The men under military detention include a colonel and 3 junior officers. One of the 5 other soldiers accused deserted in December. It's still unclear if Colonel Alfredo Benavides was the one who gave the orders. He was head of the military academy and commander of the zone in which the murders occurred. Yesterday, President Alfredo Cristiani said Benavides did order the crime, but military sources say Benavides himself is not accepting full responsibility. If the judge decides there is a case to answer, it'll be the first time so senior an officer has been charged for a human rights abuse. No officer has ever been convicted. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl today said the post-World War II border with Poland is incontestable. This statement made in Paris is the strongest one to date that Kohl has made on the issue, Deirdre Berger reports.
Germany's relations with France and Poland have been strained recently over the refusal of the West German Chancellor to guarantee Germany's border with Poland. Until now, Chancellor Kohl has maintained such a guarantee can only be given when East and West Germany are reunified and sign a peace treaty with the World War II Allied powers. In Paris today, Kohl said Germany will not link the question of reunification to an adjustment of borders. Some conservative forces in West Germany want to leave open the possibility for Germany to regain former territories now part of Poland. Kohl said Germany cannot expect a permanent reconciliation with Poland unless the Poles feel their borders are secure. The West German chancellor emphasized that German reunification can only take place with the approval of all European countries. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger reporting.
A Colombian accused of running a vast drug money laundering network pleaded guilty today. U.S. prosecutors in Tampa, Florida, say they made no deal with Gonzalo Moro Jr. in exchange for his plea. Moro was one of 7 defendants charged in a $32 million money laundering operation that prosecutors say had ties to ousted Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega. On Wall Street near the close, the Dow was down 37 points at 2655.50 in active trading. This is NPR News. The nation's merchandise trade deficit grew to $10.5 billion in November. It was the worst showing in 11 months. And American University economics professor Howard Wachtel says the worsening deficit is an ominous sign for the future.
It's a slow erosion of the position of the United States in terms of its living standard and its position in the world economy. What this means is we keep having to borrow more and more money. And it's not perceptible yet because we haven't yet faced the reckoning with this debt, which will occur in the 1990s. So we will wake up one day and discover that this enormous debt that we've been accumulating is going to have to be exorcised from our system. And when that process of exorcism starts is when the pain begins.
The Commerce Department says that while imports in November dropped slightly from October's all-time high, U.S. export sales declined even more, falling to their lowest level since last March. In other more upbeat economic reports, the government said that industrial production rose 0.4% in December, while the operating rate at U.S. factories, mines, and utilities rose 0.2% to 83.3% of capacity. After receiving reports of 87 fires, Chrysler Corporation is recalling some 625,000 1989 and 1990 model cars, this to replace the valve cover and gasket. The recalled vehicles are equipped with 2.2-liter or 2.5-liter engines and include the Chrysler LeBaron, Dodge Dynasty, and the Plymouth Sundance, as well as four-cylinder Dodge Caravans and Plymouth Voyager minivans. Chrysler says there have been no reported injuries as a result of the problem. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously today that states may collect taxes on the sale of religious materials offered by television evangelists. The decision came in a case involving the state of California and the Jimmy Swaggart Ministries. I'm Sharon Green, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on her vacation. I'm Sedge Thompson. In 1964, seeking to develop an antenna to measure various forms of radiation clearly and precisely, physicists Robert Wilson and Arno Penzias kept getting some interference, like poor reception in your stereo system, a hiss, a hum. The scientists at first feared the noise would interfere with their experiment, but in fact, the hiss was generated by photons left over from the moment the universe began, 12 to 16 billion years ago. The sounds they heard were radio fossils from the Big Bang. This discovery of what is now known as cosmic blackbody radiation helped confirm the Big Bang theory, and Wilson and Penzias received the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1978 for their work. Arno Penzias is my guest today. He's currently Vice President of Research at the AT&T Bell Labs in New Jersey, where he helps guide other scientists in the creation and effective use of information technology in our society. His new book, Ideas and Information, Managing in a High-Tech World, covers the evolution of computers, the mathematical operations underlying numerical processing, and the major differences between human and machine intelligence. In a New York Times book review, Timothy Bay wrote that Penzias has the shirt sleeves practicality of the manager combined with the scientist insider's familiarity with technology. I asked Arno Penzias how he encourages people at Bell Labs to innovate.
Well, I hope your listeners will take an honest answer. I work very hard on small rewards for good behavior. I can't tell people in advance how to innovate. All I can do is tell them when I like something, when I respond positively. And words are cheap, so I try little tokens. I give out books, T-shirts, chocolate bars, nice 400-gram, and in fact, sometimes I even give out the 5-kilogram chocolate bars in case it's a team effort. And I think that that the notion of rewarding good behavior is probably the best way of leading any human enterprise.
I mean, it makes you sound like, in many ways, kind of like Rodney Dangerfield in Back to School, you know, passing out the pens in the classroom to his colleagues. You know, sort of a salesman impressing the clients.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I mean, human institutions have, after all, are all organized around human beings, and I don't think scientists are all that different. You do try to avoid censorship. You do... Try to act as a role model, I know I do, by not worrying terribly much about making mistakes and about being willing to stick my neck out, make an estimate, come up with something which might be wrong and try to fix it later. I don't wait until I have every possible fact at my fingertips before I venture an opinion. I do label it as an opinion. I do label it as a tentative first thrust. But I think that that's another way of innovating, which is to just start out, do something, try it, and see how it works.
It sounds like you encourage the idea of failure in the research and development labs.
Absolutely. I think if we don't have failure, if we're doing everything, if we only do things which are guaranteed to succeed, we're not doing our job. Just by definition, if we're going out and looking at the unknown, some fraction of those things have to fail. Otherwise, the amount of new knowledge you can gather is pretty small. You know, one of the troubles with history books, especially the history of science, is it's almost always written in the way that the scientist would have liked to behave rather than the way it really went. All the kinds of mistakes people make, people feel guilty about and then try to hide them later from themselves and from others. And so what ultimately comes out is the... is a clear line of the of the steps of going from A to B to C to D, and all the little detours, almost all of them are left out. I think that's what I liked about The Double Helix, a book written by Jim Watson some years ago, where some of the blunders and side issues came out in his day-to-day story of how he worked on the first modeling of DNA. Human research and all in human inquiry is an iterative process, and it's fraught with dead ends. The trouble is that most of us feel a little ashamed, or maybe the word is fraudulent. We all feel that people around us overrate us, you know, that we are not quite as smart as people think we are, and we just have to kind of hide, not ask too many questions, and not betray our ignorance, so otherwise people won't find out how much dumber we are than all the people around us. And that tendency, which I find pervasive among smart people everywhere, is one that we really have to fight in a research lab. I suspect in other walks of life you have to also, in order to get people to be willing to be upfront about the mistakes they make. So they're willing to tackle something, even if they're going to be proven wrong.
A lot of scientific discoveries seem to come out of very poorly equipped labs, inexpensive equipment. Major scientific corporations like Hewlett-Packard start in garages. How important is sort of the crude beginnings for some of these discoveries?
I think the crude beginnings are very important because, after all, every idea, however great and complex, I believe, begins between one pair of human ears. And the person who's starting that work almost always begins in a small small single person or small team environment. And when we look at the really important discoveries of the past century, very few of them have been made with the biggest piece of equipment available. It's often the second or third biggest telescope that finds the galaxy rather than the biggest one, an accelerator that got to be used on a more speculative project than the top of the line model, which you have to wait years to get time on. That is something to do with the nature of discovery. Discovery is a private, I think, to a great degree, discovery is a private activity. And as private individuals, an environment which works on a human scale is often the most productive. That's not to say we don't need big machines, we don't need large and complex teams for some things, but the human spark that begins most progress starts usually on a very small scale. And much of what is ultimately discovered is often done in small groups.
You've written and talked about the idea of the invisible college, the idea of colleagues, other physicists, that you can sort of get on the phone and talk over ideas with. And in fact, your ideas about the background noise of the universe fit into somebody else's concept of a cosmology, which eventually led to understanding the Big Bang Theory, all through sort of a series of phone calls. It seems to me that science works best when it's kept open rather than secret and private in laboratories.
I think that's quite true, and I think that one of the things you find all over the world, and I think even in the countries where economies and other discipline tried to be kept in a closed environment, have found that unless one keeps this scientific openness, unless you pay your membership dues, you're not going to be part of the club. And it's kind of paradoxical, isn't it? I spoke a moment ago of science being based on individuals, loners sitting there getting an idea. But in order to refine those ideas, it takes access to other people. And that's also done on a one-on-one basis very often, but it gets socialized over a much larger group of people because there aren't all that many experts in the world, and science is highly compartmentalized because there's so much to know, and any one person can only keep a small part of it in mind at any one time.
Early on, when you were first studying science in school and going to the Brooklyn Technical School,
Technical High School,
yeah.
Right.
You noticed that there wasn't as much of a cultural bias there in the world of science. And I'm wondering if you still feel that science is a field that's fairly free of cultural bias.
I think there is less cultural bias in science than most other fields. This is why you find so many recent immigrants coming in, especially our Asian immigrants coming in large numbers into science, because you don't have to, as I didn't when I first came to America, you don't have to be able to speak English perfectly. You didn't have to go to the right school and be able to have all the right set of credentials. Much of what your ratings depend on is really in your own control in science, which is very nice. You produce a piece of work, whether it's a program or a new kind of transistor or a new understanding of polymer structure, and the way that science works, that the credit for that belongs to you. It's very different, say, from being an interviewer. You get a job in an advertising, or you get a job somewhere in a personnel department interviewing people. Well, how do you tell who the good or the bad interviewer is? And much of it has to do, I suppose, with social skills, the way the person comes across in things which have little to do with the job itself. In science, you have a little bit more freedom to be a nerd if you want, I suppose, is one way of putting it.
My guest is Nobel Prize-winning physicist Arno Penzias. His book, Ideas and Information, has just been published in paperback. Each new technology that comes along to be a time saver or an advance seems to bring with it its own then problems. Fax machines can send messages back and forth across the country, but now people are getting junk faxes tying up their machines.
Sure. I think what we have to maintain is a general dissatisfaction with technology. I think that's one of the reasons I wrote Ideas and Information. It's not a compendium of look what technology can do for you, but try to give people a basic understanding of what technology does so they can build a strategy around the kinds of things they want and demand more. For example, on a fax machine, which has storage rather than one that dumps the paper out at you, one could look at a cathode ray tube and just scan which of the pages you'd really like printed and push a button and discard the others the way you do electronic mail. It's not asking for a lot more, and I suspect in a few years some fax manufacturers are going to have that feature, and then junk fax disappears because you can screen it.
What about
you? Sound surprised?
Well, no. Well, it's part of the pleasure of sort of thinking, yeah, well, there can be a technological solution. I've seen fax machines that will store messages without printing them out, but there's no way of seeing them yet. And
yeah,
I suppose
but the thing
there
is,
are faxes.
You store them, but then you just call them up on your screen. Now there's several ways of doing that.
Well, I think that faxes connected with computers can do that.
You want to do. I mean, this is back to the notion of integration. I think one of the great opportunities in our society today is to start to integrate all the junk we have around our house. We have our hi-fi set. You've got a fax. You may have a PC. You've got a microwave oven, a burglar alarm, telephones of various kinds, your answering machine. Well, all those machines playing together could be much more valuable. And for example, when you get your messages on your answering machine, you might like to have them in the form of text. So if there's a text-to-speech recognition system there, which could turn the spoken messages into text, you can then scan them by name on a screen and then pick the ones you want to listen to, and you can junk the rest. It's not that we have too much information. The trick is that the information is in forms we really don't like and what we can't, and forms which we're not comfortable in dealing with. I mean, I don't think I have as much information today as I want. I have a lot of information I don't want, and to be able to sort through the two requires some information tools, and the tools I want are different from the ones other people would want. That's why no single recipe will help everybody.
How have you equipped your own home with new technologies, personal computers, cellular phones, something that maybe hasn't even reached the market?
Let me see. I guess, let's see. What do I have at home? No, I don't think there is a single piece of electronic. I recently bought a television set and VCR so we could watch movies at night. But in my own home, the only piece of high technology I have at all is a fax machine. We have a number of telephones. I don't have a. I did have a PC and a terminal for a while, but I just don't use it enough. I find that I do much better with the electronic mail in the office, and occasionally, if I happen to be somewhere else, my secretary will just print the stuff out and fax it to me. But as far as writing is concerned, I wrote Ideas and Information with a yellow pad and a manually sharpened number 3 pencil. So I don't find I need those things. You know, we have the usual kinds of stuff like a microwave oven and so forth and ordinary automobiles, but no trickery. I do have a telephone in my car. In fact, I have two telephones in two cars because I don't ever want to be out of touch with other people. But voice contact is usually adequate, so I don't find the need for computers or things of that sort. But I made those choices, and let me just say one more thing here. I made those choices as part of a conscious sequence of acts. That is, I did this based on knowledge. Maybe you need a PhD to be able to have the authority to say, no, I don't really want the personal computer. It's one of the things I tried to point out in my book is that everybody has the right, in fact, to them, the obligation themselves to work out a personal information processing strategy that fits them.
My guest is physicist Arno Penzias. In 1978, he won the Nobel Prize for his work with Robert Wilson. His radio astronomy work picked up background hiss, the fossil radio signals from the beginning of the universe that supported the Big Bang theory. He's now vice president of research at the AT&T Bell Labs. His book, Ideas and Information, has just come out in paperback. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm speaking with physicist Arno Penzias. I'm interested in the way social decisions are made and butt up against the world of technology. For instance, I think many people are interested in cellular telephone technology, other forms of private communication that go on. But the spectrum of broadcast bands is being taken up in large part by television channels. And I'm wondering if you see a time when society might say, we don't need 13 VHF channels, we could get by with only 10, and we'll turn the rest over to private communication.
Well, I'd be surprised if you have to attack the... Well, actually, of the 13 channels, you only get 11 because channel 1 is off for something else, right? We all start with 2 to 13, mm-hmm. So really a dozen. Well, there are a dozen VHF channels, but there are many times that amount of spectrum reserved to UHF, and that's probably a place where... I think our society may really want to go and look to see if that really is the best allocation of resources. As we move into a world where, the wires all over the building, we have wires all over buildings, and every time you want to move a desk, you have to go, all sorts of strange people come and get connectors and power supplies and all bits and pieces. I suspect that as we move into the future, be much nicer if you just have a box which you just get power for and everything else is handled by radio waves. That would take a little more spectrum than we're using today.
Mm-hmm. When you go out to the to look at the night sky, do you feel any sort of romance about the stars, or do you examine them as a scientist who sees them in terms of molecules and radiation?
Oh, not at all. I look at them in a very romantic way. I mean, I look up there and I see Orion, that friendly giant, and I often look up there and say, boy, he was really good to me. If you look at Orion's hunting knife, and the middle star of that is actually a cloud of stars and gas and dust. And some years ago, when I worked on the study of interstellar molecules, we found a large number of molecular substances up in that region, and a lot of gas which hadn't been detectable in any other way before, and so we opened up a whole new field.
My guest is Arno Penzias. His book, Ideas and Information, is a guide to the rapidly changing new information technologies. You pointed out that knowing how to work a computer is not the same as computer literacy, and now that computers are being introduced in schools for people at very young ages, I wonder if you could explain what you see as the difference.
Yeah. Learning how to operate a computer is really rote learning of a set of instructions. If you do A or B, then C will happen. And I think it's far more important to teach children something to do with the rudiments of computation something to understand how to, and then to adults as well, to understand how to plan computation, how to plan algorithms, how to organize information. The detailed implementation on the machine is the last piece you really need. You can, if you understand how computers work, what they can and can't do for you, somebody else can do the spreadsheet and you can look at it and you're all set.
One of the constant issues that comes up involving new technology is the hardware. It can look very pretty, it can do wonderful things, but often you have the question of what to do with it. I was interested in the beginnings of AT&T when investors were saying, sell the telephones, and somebody came along and said, no, actually what you want to do is sell the idea of connectivity, that what's actually going on is the ability to link people together.
I think what we've seen is a revolution in value. Value used to reside in things. Value today resides far more in intangibles, such as the ability to connect people together, the knowledge groups of people have on how to operate a particular system, the software, if you will, that underlies computing. All those are intangibles. They don't really they don't really exist in the same way as people had ingots of gold or hogsheads of rum. So we've moved away from the physical into something which is more information based. I don't have a good word for it, so that's why I talked about it in stories or anecdotes rather than try to philosophize.
Mm-hmm. In the interest of passing information around, what technology are you and your researchers playing with at the labs that looks very exciting that we might not yet know about?
Well, I would think right now the things I'm most excited about today are our work in speech and images. Not that we couldn't recognize some kinds of speech in the past, and not that you can't today buy a computer which can speak to you like this. But we're getting to the point where in a few years, I suspect we will get the recognition of fluent speech. And then coupling that with some of the pattern matching things that we're going to be able to get computers to do, we will have machines which, while they have nothing, they resemble in no way the intelligent machines that people talked about a few years ago when the hype of artificial intelligence was at its height. You'll find these machines will be able to do things which even some of the artificial intelligence people didn't dare predict because it would seem too difficult. And we do it with dumb machines simply because we're able to create algorithms to do to do that kind of work.
It sounds like you must get up each day very excited about going to work.
Oh, yeah. Well, the only trouble is sometimes I get up when it isn't even time to get up, and I look at my clock and say 2 o'clock in the morning, I start thinking about something, and then I say, well, now I better, come on, shut up and go to sleep or something. I got to sleep now. And it's hard because there's so many exciting things. I think the loveliest thing about my job is the number of people who are excited about their work and are willing to explain things to me. So I get to learn about lots of stuff, and there is lots going on. It really is magic. It's kind of a... It's kind of a miracle that I have this job. I have this opportunity to learn about all sorts of technology and share some of that knowledge with others. It's really great.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Well, glad to do it.
Arno Penzias' book, Ideas and Information, has just come out in paperback. Dr. Penzias won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1978. He's now Vice President of Research at AT&T Bell Labs. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we'll have a concert with Yomo Toro. He plays music from the hills of Puerto Rico on his 10-string guitar called a cuatro. He'll be joined by bass and percussion. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. W.H. Macy has enjoyed a long artistic association with playwright David Mamet as an actor and as a director. He's appeared in Mamet's plays and movies, and now he's directing the professional debut of Mamet's play, Squirrels. Coming up, we meet W.H. Macy. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Sweetie, the tale of one very eccentric Australian family as directed by a New Zealander. That's all coming up here on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. Soviet troops have been given permission to open fire on Azerbaijani and Armenian militants engaged in a virtual civil war. A Soviet television report says soldiers can shoot in self-defense and to protect arms and ammunition dumps. Despite the presence of more than 11,000 troops in Azerbaijan, ethnic battles continue. Meanwhile, in Moscow, Armenian refugees are furious over Azerbaijani attacks on their comrades. The BBC's Philip Short prepared this report.
Armenian demonstrators outside the Communist Party Central Committee building here in Moscow, leaving Mr. Gorbachev in no doubt of their anger at the massacre of their compatriots and the government's failure to prevent it. Some 5,000 Armenians have been evacuated from Baku, most of them by sea to Turkmenia, and the situation in the city is said to be still very tense. Elsewhere, an Interior Ministry spokesman said the level of fighting between Armenian and Azerbaijani nationalists confronting each other in the hills around the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh had lessened following the successful deployment of troops. The known death toll is still rising. It's now over 70, and both sides have been making renewed attempts to seize tanks and heavy weapons from military bases, as well as small arms and ammunition.
Philip Short in Moscow. A top Colombian government official says it's not likely that a peace offer from the so-called extraditables will be accepted. The drug lords reportedly offered to end their terror campaign and stop exporting cocaine in exchange for amnesty. In Washington today, President Bush dismissed the reported offer. The Colombian government today extradited to the U.S. two suspects wanted for allegedly running a cocaine trafficking ring between Colombia and the U.S. The two, a brother and sister, were turned over to U.S. marshals. They were indicted by a federal grand jury in Greensboro, North Carolina, in 1988. Several hundred people blocked the doors of the federal building in downtown Los Angeles today and called on Congress to end all aid to El Salvador. Nancy Clark reports.
Wearing white bandanas over their faces, representing people in El Salvador who they say have to hide from government-sponsored death squads, more than 200 people were arrested as they linked arms blocking the doors to the downtown federal building. Among those taken into federal custody and booked were actors Ed Asner, David Clennon, and singer Jackson Brown.
And I really think that it's time for people in Congress who have been hoping that Christiani's government could get control of the military, it's time for them to admit that that's not happening and to cut off military aid.
Next week, when Congress reconvenes, organizers say they'll take their protest to the offices of local congressmen who have refused to support legislation presented in the House to end all war-related aid to El Salvador. For National Public Radio, I'm Nancy Clark in Los Angeles.
The Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 34 points at 2659.13. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. W.H. Macy's long association with David Mamet began when he was a student of Mamet's at Goddard College. Since then, Macy has acted in several of Mamet's plays, including the original productions of American Buffalo, The Water Engine, and last year's production at Lincoln Center of Bobby Gould in Hell. Macy's also performed in the two films directed by Mamet, House of Games and Things Change, and the two worked together at Chicago's St. Nicholas Theater and are co-founders of their Atlantic Theater Company in New York. Last year, Mamet was executive producer and Macy the director for the HBO TV play Lip Service, which won an ACE Award. Macy is in Philadelphia this week to direct a revival of the Mamet play called Squirrels. It's a three-character, one-act play about the process of writing. I asked Macy what the advantage is to work in the same orbit of writers and actors that gravitate to these Mamet productions.
It's just more fun to work with your pals than it is to work with strangers. And also, auditions are the worst creatures that God ever invented. I mean, they're just horrifying experiences for everyone involved. So it's just easier to call up someone you know. It's more fun.
Is there a sort of a set of codes or unspoken language that begins to develop between you that makes directing and acting, collaborating easier?
I think so. You don't have to take time to get to know each other. You know, doing a play, regardless of the play, is a very intimate experience. The actors are called upon to be intimate with each other almost instantly. We had 3 weeks rehearsal for this thing, and even there's an intimacy that's required when people are screaming at each other. If you're really going to do it, if you're really going to tell the truth to each other, you got to take off the gloves and yell at the other guy. Well, you can't do that with a stranger. So what happens when it's a pickup team through the audition process is that you're called to be intimate with someone that you hardly even know. And in the worst case scenario, people literally climb in bed together who have known each other for a week. So I hate that stuff. And yeah, if you're working with your pals, you can bypass all that. If this is the third or fourth play, you know each other and get right to work.
You also have a history with this production of Squirrels. You acted in it when it was a production 14 years ago.
Oh, God, yeah.
How did you change your point of view on the play, or did you, from being an actor in it to being the director of it?
It was an important play for me because it was sort of seminal. It was the first play we did in Chicago, and I think I'd have to say it was the first professional play I ever did for actual civilians out there to come in and see, where the money being lost was my money. And I remembered the production a lot. Other plays that I've done, I can't remember them 5 days after it closes. I couldn't remember one of the lines. It goes right out of my head. But I remembered this one because it was so important to me. Also, it's got such memorable lines, as you well know. So my point of view changed in that I got to see it, which is a thrill. I've just been delighted to watch something. I guess it would be like watching yourself grow up. If you could go back and look at yourself as a five-year-old, it's just such great fun to see something that was so important to me right in front of my eyes. Now I'm a spectator.
I'm interested in how a play gets from the two-dimensionality of the printed page and upright, you know, into three dimensions.
Well, you analyze the script for actions, and then the actors drill what those actions are, the objectives, if you will, if you want to be technical about it. Once they know what their objectives are, the way I work, we sit around a table. Of the 3 weeks, we spent the first week around the table, and we broke the script down into its acting objectives, the beats, if you will, and we practice that from the table, just reading it over and over again. The result of that is the second week, when you put it on its feet, blocking really becomes so logical, because if Arthur knows what he wants from Edmund at that point, the two characters in the play, all I got to do is say, start there. He's got to move. The blocking, the staging of it becomes obvious because he's got to go over there if he wants that. So it's quite organic, I find. If the actors understand what they're doing, what they want from the other guy, the thing just springs to life. It's not difficult at all.
Somebody made the observation that even the ums and the ahs are all very carefully scripted. But hell for an actor to try to memorize.
Oh, my God. They went insane.
Any tricks that help you memorize David Mamet's sort of very carefully scored plays?
Nah, it's just hard work. I memorize in the morning, and I don't do it for more than 2 hours at a time because my mind turns to mush. If you really concentrate, you can memorize three or four pages at a clip. I mean, even if it's three or four pages of monologue. It's just hard work. I used to say, I thought it was so cool to say, people would say, how do you memorize all those lines? And I would say in a cavalier offhand way, oh, that's the easiest part. The hard part is figuring out what the guts of the project are. Well, that's just so much turkey talk. I hate memorizing lines. It's the worst part of the whole business. And there's nothing to be done except sit down and do it. Poor the folks in this thing, Todd Weeks and Natalia Nogalich and Roger Serbigi, they just went insane. They've been running these lines forever. The ums are important, too, because he writes, that's one of the reasons he's our greatest writer. Everything is in metered. Everything is has a rhythm, a specific rhythm, and it is not natural speech. It's poetry. It's iambic pentameter, usually. And you can hear it after they get the lines down. If they paraphrase one little bit, if one comes in the wrong spot, it's as if someone was walking across the floor and suddenly tripped on something. The rhythm gets knocked off, and it's not as pretty, it's not as funny, it's not as fluid as it was. Those mostly have to do with rhythm.
I imagine that at some point the play leaves the venue of the playwright. It becomes sort of the director's to help shape it. And at what point does it leave you as the director and sort of becomes the actor's play?
Well, that's a great question. I would guess that the actors know more about the play than the director after the second or third performance of it in front of an audience. They start to take it over. Some directors won't give it up. As an actor, I've experienced that. They keep wanting to get in and tinker with what I'm doing. And at that point, I've always felt me as the actor. Hey, I'm the expert on it now. Which is not to say that the director, that it doesn't need an outside point of view, because an actor can only see what he's doing. You can't see the overall picture. But second or third preview, I'd say that the actors know more about this play than I do now.
Is that process different when you work with David Mamet in film like House of Games or Things Change?
Well, movies are different in general. Mm-hmm. The process of rehearsing a play is essentially creating habits, creating habitual behavior. Because let's face facts, when you do a play, even if it's a long run, most of it is essentially on autopilot. If you have one moment in every scene, one organic moment where the muse comes down and sits on your shoulder for a while, that's a good night. You're doing good work. If you have one spontaneous organic moment, the rest of it is, you know, you're doing what you habitually do. In movies, because they're rehearsed so little, you don't have time to create any habits. So it's really seat-of-the-pants sort of acting. All you got to do is get it right once, with everyone else getting it right at the same time, and then you go on. So, yeah, the director really stays over your shoulder there.
I've been talking with actor and director Bill Macy. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor and director W.H. Macy. Before we get back to our conversation, let's hear a clip from the HBO movie Lip Service, which Macy directed. It starred Griffin Dunne and Paul Dooley.
History in the making, huh?
How do you mean?
Well, our first show and all.
Yes, your first. Good luck.
Well, Louis, this looks like the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Pardon?
You know, Casablanca. Bogey, end of the movie.
Ah.
Famous line.
I'm afraid I'm not a real student of film.
Oh. Hell, you were probably there.
Where?
Casablanca.
No.
Still, you've been around. Korea, right? Vietnam?
Here and there.
Don't kid me. I know my history. Those were the days, huh? Getting your hands dirty? That was journalism.
That's what we called it. Well, those were different times.
Come on.
Much different from today.
You directed a movie called Lip Service.
Right.
That was also filled with words and wordplay and images of television. And it seemed very Mamet-like. Uh-huh. It was written by Howard Corder, and I guess I mean that in the complimentary sense.
Right.
What is it that attracts you to plays and productions that tend to have that kind of meaty word game?
It seems to me that you say it's Mamet-like. To me, that means it's good writing, because David's writing is always beautiful. American Buffalo is the greatest example, or Glengarry Glen Ross. I mean, they're such coarse plays. They deal with coarse men duking it out in these underhanded kind of ways. And so one would look at it and say, well, it's about lowlifes. And yet, the language, if you study it, is so beautifully sculpted. So what do I like with writers? I like beautiful language that's got a specific voice which has a meter and a rhyme and a rhythm which is pleasant to the ear. And I like it to be American because I like things American. It's got to speak to my ear. The way I can listen to Shakespeare and love it and appreciate it, but it ain't my voice. Howard Korter is one of the great writers these days, and I think a lot of times he's compared to David, and I don't think it's fair. It's good writing, the end, and it seems to me that all good writing is going to share certain qualities. Like people used to say that David was very much like Mr. Pinter. Well, they're not really alike. They have certain similar qualities in that it's so beautifully sculpted, but two completely different voices. And I think David and Howard are two completely different voices.
Was Lip Service first television
it was
movie
made,
direction?
Made for HBO. Mm-hmm. First, it was a one-act play by Howard Korter at the Punchline, Manhattan Punchline, in Manhattan, strangely enough. And then HBO bought it, and then I came on. I don't know how I got to direct that. I had never directed something. It was just a treat to work on. It's dry. Boy, it's as dry as can be. But everyone liked it a lot.
Lip Service is a television play set within a television studio.
Right.
What did you decide to have most fun with in that context of kind of a play within a play?
Well, it was the first one I ever did, so I'll tell you the truth. I didn't have fun with anything. It was the most horrifying experience. Not only did I not know the answer to most of the questions I was asked, I couldn't understand what the questions were. So I was making everything up, and they come at you a million miles an hour. The thing if I had any fun, it was in the week of rehearsal before we started shooting. And that is rehearsing just like in a play. And there I was in my elephant. I knew what I was doing there. And Paul Dooley and Griffin Dunn were the two guys. And they were just wonderful actors. Paul Dooley is like an American treasure. And so we had fun there. The technical stuff, it was the most fun when I finally got in the editing room and could put it together. Because that's like putting together a puzzle, something that you screwed up in shooting. You can try to fix with the editing. It's great fun. Also, we used a Netflix, so you actually got to pick up the film and sling it over you. I did some of the cutting myself. You got this big garbage can filled with outtakes, and you've got three things of film around your neck and two others that you're holding up to the light, and you cut them all together and recut them. That was great. I love that stuff. That went on for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
Was there a moment in your youth, you know, when you were 8, 9, 10, when you discovered you had fun with words? And
I was a terrible student, and the only thing I could do was talk. I talked myself out of most of the situations I got in. I just made wretched grades my whole life, but I was always pretty good at talking. So when I graduated from high school, I had done really well. They had what they call the Welcome Home Award, which is sort of a popularity contest for seniors. And I won that, which was a big to-do. And at the same time, they were wondering if I was going to graduate because my grades were so wretched. So good for me that I had won that award, because they were thinking, we can't flunk the guy. We can't flunk the guy that got the Welcome Home Award. They call me and they say, we don't have a grade for you for geometry. I said, well, I didn't take geometry. I said, no, you have to take geometry, but we don't have the grade. I said, well, I didn't take geometry. I said, no, you must take geometry. I said, I took Algebra 1 and 2. I said, we know that, but you must take geometry. So what's your grade? I said, I didn't take geometry. We went like that for 5 minutes. This is 2 weeks before graduation. I don't think my diploma is real. I don't think it's legitimate. I talked my way out of everything.
You play a Marine in a scene in a Western Union telegraph office in The House of Games, a movie that David Mamet directed. And it's the scene where Joe Montaigne and Lindsay Krauss are working the first con. And the idea of the con of persuading somebody to believe that you're somebody you're not seems to be integral to the acting profession. And I'm wondering, do you see yourself when you're an actor as pulling off a con?
No, not really. When you combine what the actor is doing with the script and the production, the sets, the lights, the costumes, all of that stuff, the result is an illusion which looks like a con. There was an interesting thing. Dave Mamet was on Dick Cavett's show a couple of years ago, and Cavett said something to the effect of, well, really what an actor does is lie. I mean, that's what they do for a living. They just lie. They lie very well. And David looked at him sort of confusedly, watch your adverbs, confusedly, and said, no, actors are paid to tell the truth. And Cavett said, yeah, but they're lying. And David said, no, they're telling the truth. Then Cavett said, well, we're really both saying the same thing. Well, they weren't. And I don't think they could have said two different things if they had tried. It's an actor's job to tell the truth under imaginary circumstances. And the result will be an illusion. I suddenly become the character. But what the actor's doing is something simple and direct, and he's telling the truth at any given time.
There's a sketch that shows up in Squirrels at one point where Arthur the writer is describing the structure of of a story he wants to write. You start out with nothing, rising, your climax, and then you fall and you're left with nothing. Do you feel sometimes after a production ends that, and the stage is empty again, that you started with nothing and you're left with nothing again?
Yeah. It doesn't make me sad, though. I just love that. I feel that we're like the people in the... That's why I love the theater. You had to have been there. If you missed it, you missed it. It's gone. It's sort of a Sisyphean myth, and on one level, I mean, we just keep doing the same thing and there's nothing to show for it. But in the minds of the people that did get to be there at that moment, it's so thrilling. And I love the idea that we create something that will just go away. There will be no record, and it's done. It's so now. So it's bittersweet, but I just sort of love it when after the last one and you see them tearing down the set the next day. I kind of like that. I don't know why.
Well, Bill Macy, thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh Air.
It's been great talking to you.
Actor and director W.H. Macy. He's currently directing a production of David Mamet's play Squirrels for the Philadelphia Festival of New Plays. His next project, directing a Mamet play for a live radio broadcast on public radio. This is Fresh Air. Later today on National Public Radio is today's edition of All Things Considered. Welcome to host Robert Siegel. Thanks for coming by to give us a preview.
Sure, Sedge. Hi. We'll have news today about the fighting in Azerbaijan and great fear in Armenia as refugees from Azerbaijan arrive in the capital city of Armenia, Yerevan. Also, a story about the verdict of acquittal in the McMartin preschool trial, the child molestation trial in Los Angeles. A report on a house call program, a hospital in Baltimore that visits elderly patients in the neighborhood where they feel that care can be much more effective than in the hospital in many cases. And also about discrimination within the FBI.
Encyclopedic as usual. Thank you, Robert. All that on All Things Considered later here on National Public Radio. The short films of director Jane Campion wowed him at the Cannes Film Festival 4 years ago. One of her movies, Peel, won the Palme d'Or for Best Short Film, so critics eagerly awaited her new feature movie, Sweetie. It's been screened at several festivals and opens this week in New York and next month in several other cities. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
When I saw Sweetie for the first time at last year's Cannes Film Festival, the movie was roundly booed, and no wonder. This film isn't always easy to take. It's the first feature of the 35-year-old New Zealand director Jane Campion, and though it starts out as a kind of surreal romantic comedy, it gets starker and more tragic as it goes along, without ever sacrificing its creepy sense of humor. This movie tickles you one minute and then slaps the grin off your face the next. In its way, it's as disturbing as David Lynch's film Blue Velvet. The setting is a blasted Australian suburbia. And the subject is love. Not the swoony ecstasy of romantic fiction, but love as a burden, as a monster, as a spooky supernatural current. For the movie's wan heroine, Kay, played rather awkwardly by Karen Colston, romance has always seemed sort of sinister. That's because it's organic, and organic processes give her the heebie-jeebies. Trees, for instance, bother her, because when she was growing up, her princessy little sister, Dawn, also known as Sweetie, was given a wonderful treehouse to play in. Now trees remind Kay of Sweetie, and anything that reminds her of Sweetie drives her around the bend. All of which is pretty hard to figure until we finally meet Sweetie herself. That is, when she breaks into Kay's runty little house and makes herself at home.
Who's he?
My producer. Bob, meet Kay. Kay, Bob.
You've stopped taking your medication, haven't you?
Yeah, well, Bob and I are really going to walk through some doors, Kay. We're really getting it together.
Tell him to take off Louis's jacket. You can't stay, you know that.
Oh, yeah, well, if it wasn't so late, we'd go, you know, but I just wanted to see you and say hi there.
As played by the remarkable Genevieve Lemon, Sweetie is fat, noisy, and dangerously mercurial. She's appetite personified, hungry for love, for food, for attention, for everything. And at first, the movie seems to be turning into an eerie, Pinterest power struggle. But Jane Campion's vision is broader than that. Young Sweetie turns out to be not just annoying, but schizophrenic, even terrifying. And Campion's movie soon becomes a lacerating examination of the way family ties chafe and squeeze, of the pain of having to love someone incapable of inspiring love. Kay, we soon realize, can't love or even let herself feel, because loving and feeling to her bring the image of Sweetie bubbling to the surface, and Sweetie is her life's one great, unappeasable horror. The actors are all newcomers, and some of them probably don't have much of a career ahead of them. But their stiffness is oddly right for Campion's skewed style. Her color compositions have a weird, bleak beauty all their own, with characters bobbing oddly in the corner of the frame, as though they'd been shoved into our sightline by accident. Campion's style owes more perhaps to photography than to the realm of film. It reminds you of the work of Gary Winogrand and Diane Arbus. It turns banality into a freak show, and freakishness into the stuff of everyday life. But there's also an astringent compassion in this film. And if you can get past the weirdness and remoteness of the characters, you may find yourself at times almost inexplicably moved. Campion and her co-writer, Gerard Lee, have created a sublimely unsettling work, one of the most arresting and original films I've seen in years.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. The film is Sweetie. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Verblaitis, Dan Lachlan, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a live concert with the master of Puerto Rican jibaro music, Yomo Toro, and we talk with film director Mike Figgis about the blood and the tears and the sweat in his new movie, Internal Affairs. That and more next time on Fresh Air.